Amen. We started this session talking about what a human is, and that meant we looked at humans as complex beings, not simple beings, and that we're made up of at least two parts, material and immaterial, or flesh and spirit. And we talked about the possibility that we could have three parts, body, soul, and spirit, and we spent quite a bit of time on that. In that, we considered what could be considered a Christian perspective. And then beyond that, some perspectives that are outside the pale of Christianity. And as we work through theology from here on out, we'll have to deal with a variety of traditions that have posited themselves for the last 2,000 years since Christ. And occasionally, regularly, we'll have to rule one of them out, even though it might need to be in the Journal of Christian History, but we rule it out because it's not Christian. And you've been here and we've done some of that. So we move from who we are as humans to what is the nature of sin, and that's where we studied the doctrine of original sin. And we've spent three full weeks on that, almost four. And when we say original sin, we're not just talking about the fact that there was an original sin in the garden with Adam and Eve, but Christianity speaks of the doctrine of original sin, meaning what was that and what effect did that have on humans. And there we were introduced to the traditional views. Remember, we had the first view being Pelagianism, who argued historically that it had no effect, and he would be one, or that would be a perspective that we would say is not a reasonable, and or more than that, is not a Christian perspective. To deny original sin would be unorthodox, would not be Christian. And so although we've talk now continually about Pelagianism and Pelagius and the fact that all of us as humans are really born that way. That's how we think. And primarily that's because we as humans have some innate sense of justice. And the idea that an original sin, i.e. 6,000 years or so ago, that Adam could have sinned and that sin could have had a direct impact on me violates our sense of justice. It doesn't seem fair that I could be held guilty for a sin that I did not commit, and more than that, one that happened 6,000 years ago. And so we wrestle with that, and that every time we wrestle with that and our sense of justice rises up and says that can't be true, we are showing our natural bent toward Pelagianism, because that's exactly what Pelagius was arguing, that just cannot be true. But discounting that, we also considered that there are still options as it regards the effect of the fall. And so if you've been here, we looked at Augustinianism and what Augustine taught the effect of the fall was. And then most recently, last week, we looked at Arminianism and what Arminius taught was the effect of the fall on humanity. Now, inevitably, Augustinianism and Arminianism have both fallen within, historically, Christian parameters. They're both considered Christian perspectives. And we'll deal with that more carefully when we get into the doctrine of salvation or justification. But for now, just accept that, and you can study it yourself. It is considered Christian to be an Augustinian, or more modernly called a Reformed or Calvinist persuasion, concerning original sin. We're only talking about original sin. And it's also acceptable to be an Arminian and agree with that perspective concerning original sin. Augustinianism today would look like Reformed theology, would look like a Christian Reformed church, a Presbyterian church. Again, we're not talking about their doctrine of salvation or church government. We're just talking about their view of original sin. Or we could more simply say it would look like our church. We are Augustinian in our treatment and what we believe about the effects of original sin. But Arminianism is also very, in fact, we might argue, predominant, certainly in the Bible Belt. And we've talked about that. All Methodist churches being Wesleyan in their root, who was Arminian in his roots, would all be Arminian as it regards original sin. So we have this accepted tolerance, and there's lines all in between there, right? You've all lived enough in a Christian context to realize there's 217 different Baptist denominations, so to try to categorize that is a little bit challenging. But generally speaking, we're dealing with two traditions and their perspective on original sin. Those two are Augustinianism and Arminianism. Now, having said that those are acceptable, inevitably the distinction boils down to will and whether or not we maintain, irrespective of what happened at the fall, do we maintain a freedom to make inevitably a choice that would determine our eternal destiny, our eternal course? In other words, did the fall limit the freedom of our will in any sense, and if so, how? So that's where we're going to pick up. Now, if you've not been here, you're going to be a little lost, at least at the beginning, because we're going to jump right into or back into Arminianism and what Arminius taught. But this time we're going to pull out not where he was going with original sin, but where did he go with the will? All right, so we're going to pull out, these quotes are the same you saw, some of them, but now we're going to focus, and I've highlighted them to help you. We're going to focus on what he wrote, what he taught, what Arminianism historically would believe about the will. So here's what he says. Now, he starts by saying, in this state, and what he means by that, the natural state. You're born this way. What is the natural state of man? In this state, watch, the free will of man, and I'm just going to skip down, has no powers whatever except such as are excited by divine grace. Now, he would say that that will was wounded, maimed, infirm, bent, weakened, imprisoned, destroyed, and lost. So let's just take that, and that's being far too simplistic, but let's do that. Let's take that and say, what did Arminius believe was the effect of the fall on the will of man? Answer, devastating. It devastated the will of man. Arminius would teach that man does not maintain a free will because of the fall in his natural state. So that's what we're pulling out of just this one statement. I know that's not really fair. You'll just have to accept that and do your own digging to see if I'm being fair. Now let's go on. He then says, the utter weakness of all the powers to perform that which is truly good and to admit the perpetration of that which is evil is not possible because the man in his natural state is altogether dead in sin. Now we know from last week he sounds Augustinian as regards the effects of the fall on our humanity, but what we're looking at now is just follow the will. What happened to the will? It was utterly destroyed. What's the effect of that? The inability to perform that which is truly good. And so for our context tonight, so that you're tracking with me, the inability to will to do that which is truly good. So that's what we mean when we say the will. It's the choice. It's the determination. And he's saying, Arminius is, that the fall has hampered that, has destroyed that. The will, we might surmise from his position, is dead. It's dead because of sin. Then he talks about, remember, the principle of sufficient grace that has to be laid down, but this grace that is laid down through the fault of him to whom it is granted, in other words, God grants a grace, and it's a grace that he must grant, and it's a grace sufficient, but remember last week, it's not a grace efficient. It's not an effective grace. It only has the possibility of being effective. The contingent factor is us. So that's what he's speaking of. The sufficient grace through the fault of us doesn't always obtain its effect. So, as a review, Arminius teaches that there is a work of God, a work of grace that is sufficient but not always efficient. It's only efficient if we make the choice to make it efficient. That's the idea. Now, already you might be sensing this becomes a bit problematic because our will has been completely destroyed and can't make good choices. So what this sufficient grace is doing, if it's even providing the possibility of a positive effect, it must be doing to the... Anybody with me? If this grace is grace at all that even affords the possibility of being effective, then its effectiveness or what it's doing to a human, it is doing to the human's will. It is doing to the human's will. Something has to be done to the human's will in order for this grace to possibly be effective. Doesn't necessarily mean it'll be effective. But the change that's happening, that he imagines is happening to the will. It's not necessarily saving him, so obviously it's not saving grace, but it's a sufficient grace to allow him the possibility to be saved, and what it's doing its work on then is his will. It's reclaiming his will And we would say, Arminius would say, it is setting his will free to now be free to choose in a responsible way whether or not the proffer of grace might inevitably become saving grace. So if you were here, and if you weren't here, I'll tell you now, this is where we get the right understanding of Arminian theology that requires that anyone who is saved has two works of grace, two separate works of grace. The first is a sufficient grace, enabling the will to now be free to choose. The second is a saving grace that is determined by what? By the will that had been set free to make the choice. Does it make sense? A little bit? Hope so. Very important. We're focusing a laser on the will because the will becomes critical in Arminian theology. In fact, the will becomes supreme as it regards the inevitable salvation of any human being in Arminian theology. Now, here's a way of summarizing what Arminius has taught and what Arminians would teach today. Here's what's at the heart of it. No one can be responsible unless that person is free. It's a contrary to justice to imagine holding someone responsible for, let's say it this way, a choice they made if that choice wasn't a free choice. So, fundamental to the logic of this theology is responsibility demands freedom. If you aren't free, you can't be held responsible. Number two, you can't be free in any real sense of the word unless you're able. So first of all, you cannot be held responsible unless you had the freedom to make the right choice. And you can't be said to have had that freedom unless you had the ability to make that choice. Right? Just follow the logic. It's not that confusing. So what has to happen is God has to make man what? Able. Because if God can make man able, man will become free. And if man becomes free, man can now be held responsible for whatever choice he makes. Anything else, according to Arminian theology, would be unjust. God could not act any other way. And so you see what they have defended is the justice of God. The justice of God. Now, we're not here to focus on whether we agree with that or don't agree with that or taking it apart. We spent more time on that last week. I just want to be sure you understand the logic. It's really not convoluted. It's very reasonable logic. You can't hold somebody responsible for something they didn't have a free choice in making, and they can't be said to have had a free choice if they didn't actually have the ability to make the choice in the beginning. And because man doesn't have either of those things in his natural state, then what God has to do is make man able to be free to choose, and then he holds him responsible for the choice that he makes. Very reasonable. So again, when God does that, makes man able through prevenient grace, what is that grace affecting? The will. Liberating the will, making a will that before was not free, now free, so that when that free will makes its choice, God will then exercise his judgment, and he'll do so justly. Make sense? Okay, got some nodding heads. If just two of you get it, I'm good with that. So two of you nodded your head, so here we go. Now, I'm putting a lot of emphasis on free will, and some might argue that's an unfair perspective of Arminianism. It's a not a fair representation of Arminius drawn out of a few quotes that you threw up, and you would be right. It would not be fair if that's all that he said about it. But I'm saying we have fairly understood his argument that now reaches a crescendo around this very issue, and now these are his words. What then, you ask, does free will do? I reply with brevity. It saves. Take away free will, and nothing will be left to be saved. Take away grace, and nothing will be left as the source of salvation. This work, and now he makes certain we know he's talking about the work of salvation, cannot be affected without two parties. One, from whom it may come, the other, to whom or in whom it may be wrought. God, then, is the author of salvation. Free will is only capable of being saved. No one except God is able to bestow salvation, and nothing except free will is capable of receiving it. Now, it's this quote and the subsequent theology that has derived from that quote that leads me to say that the entirety of the rest of Arminian theology, as you remember, the determinations you make today or around these issues of humanity and sin and the will, set you on a course that determines how then a person will or can be saved. You can't change course out there unless you come back and correct what you believed back here, because theology needs to stay consistent. It can't contradict itself. You can't have one doctrine of humanity and another doctrine of justification that's incompatible with that. And so when we say that the doctrine of salvation in Arminian theology hinges on the will, we are fair in saying that. Anyone is fair in saying that because that's what he just said. I think that's clear. It hinges on the will. And one might argue, well, then are you saying it's salvation by grace plus works? And what is his answer? No. Only the grace works. But the grace will only work on a free swinging hinge. It will not work on any other hinge. And one might say, well, Jacob, you told us the hinge was broken. So how then could anybody be saved? If this is saving grace, a grace that only God can afford, but that is only effective on a free swinging will, and you taught us already that the will was broken, how is this ever possible? Well, we already know his answer. A first grace, a before grace. That's prevenient. Doesn't mean it prevents. It means it comes before. It comes from a Latin word. Comes before. There is a grace that must come before saving grace. Everybody with me? Otherwise, the hinge is still broken, and God can pour out all the saving grace he wants to, but it cannot have an effect on a broken will. The will first has to be fixed. And prevenient grace fixed it, and now that free will is capable of receiving saving grace. If you've been in this church very long, when we've dealt with the doctrines of justification, you have heard me say, and I've said it many times, so it's likely most of you have heard me say, that Arminians worship at the altar of free will. And this is why I say that. Because everything hinges on a free-moving will. Because without it, of Arminius's own words, you cannot be saved. All right? So here's our question inevitably for tonight with that little bit of a background concerning why now we've moved from humanity to sin to the doctrine of original sin, and now we're focusing on one thing alone, the will. Because now we're now fleshing out the distinctions, not between Pelagianism, that's not Christian, between Arminianism and Augustinianism, it really now has boiled down to this, because there's an agreement on original sin. We completely agree, it's all broken. But it now all boils down to this, what about the will? So here's tonight's question. Do we really have a free will? Is there such a thing as a free will? Well, to ask such a question begs this question. What is free will? What do we mean when we use the phrase free will? If I say this all boils down to whether or not you believe a person has a free will, it is fair for you to say, well, what do you mean by that? So let's just give that a stab before we go any further. What do we mean when we say, and it's a fairly pedestrian term, it's not the first time I suspect any of you have ever heard that phrase. What do we mean when we say free will? Not whether or not we have it. What is it that we're debating we might or might not have? Any answers? The ability to make choices. Which sounds a lot like my definition that says the personal attribute of humans that allows them to make choices. What is the choice that we make? The choosing is called our will, volition, choice. And now we're talking about, is that will free? So we're arguing it's the ability to will. That's free will, as opposed to the ability not to will. Right? You could have the ability to will, and therefore it would be free to choose. Otherwise, you have to redefine the word choice. Or you don't have the ability to choose. If we distill that down, that's what we're talking about. We know what a will is, a determination, a volition. The question is, do you have it or don't you? if you do have it, then you are presupposing that it's functional and can actually make a choice. So that's just the first part of the question. That's what we mean by free will. Let's try another definition. I just worked that one out. I'm not saying it's the right one. We swapped notes earlier today. We were watching the golf, and I set him up. I said, you set him up, I'll knock him down. No. What's another answer? Anybody else? So Craig's talking about the ability to choose. That's our will. But in order for that will to have been truly free, then it has to be able, equally able, to choose what it is inclined to choose, or even to choose what it might be disinclined to choose. In other words, it needs to have the freedom of contrary choice, the freedom to choose contrary to other considerations. It needs to be unencumbered, undirected, unconstrained, or we might say it's not free. Let's do one more. Do we have another one? Okay, let's don't dwell here. Let's press on. Here's three primary positions concerning this issue we're talking about, the will and its freedom. Position number one, fatalism. Number one is fatalism. How do we speak of will as it regards humans? There are those who believe in fatalism. We'll define that in a minute. Number two is compatibilism, or sometimes called determinism. We'll talk about that one in a minute. And the third one is libertarianism. Okay, those are the three primary views that you can have concerning the will in its natural state, fallen man. These are your three primary choices. We could even extrapolate that further and say, after you're regenerated, how do we view this? Does the view change? Now, like I said earlier, some of these can be tolerated, some can't always be tolerated. Let's define them real quickly, and pretty quickly we'll rule one out. Fatalism is the belief that a person's life and choices are totally and unalterably the result of an endless series of cause and effect. In other words, they're random. Entirely random. That's fatalism. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. You're not really a determiner in any real sense of the word. Fatalism would argue you don't really have a will in that regard. You're choosing, but it means nothing. Cause and effect, that's it. It's kind of like evolution, just going to happen a certain way. Compatibilism or determinism is the belief that a person's actions are free and are determined. Determined by his or her character and desires. So they're both free and determined. In other words, they don't exist in a vacuum. They're not that kind of free. As opposed to libertarianism, which is the belief that a person's actions are, I could say, free and uncaused by any coercion whatsoever. Sometimes it's called indeterminalism. The agent is the first cause of the effect of his or her action. In other words, that kind of freedom is the freedom to choose that does not exist prior to the choice. You birth it. You are the cause and the effect at once. In compatibilism and determinism, the action of choice is believed to have been the result of a prior cause. The choice is the effect. That effect always has a cause. Libertarianism says that as it regards human will, the cause and effect are the same thing. You choose to do what you choose to do because you chose to do it. That's the argument. That's the philosophical perspective. It does not exist before that, and it has no cause other than that you did it. And then when you did it, you were both the cause and the effect. That's called libertarian free will. Absolutely free. There's nothing going on there until you do it. Okay? Now, on the left-hand side is fatalism. At the other end of the spectrum is indeterminism or libertarianism. Over here, the simple reality is nobody is responsible for anything. You can't be responsible for anything because it's just a natural order of cause and effect. Over here, you're responsible for everything because you were absolutely free to do whatever it is you did. And there was nothing that caused you to do it until you did it. So this is the most responsible a person could be as it regards the will. This is the least responsible, in fact, irresponsible a person is as it regards his will. And in the middle is what we would argue is compatibilism. Not that they're not responsible, but not that they're so responsible that there's not a cause that's at work producing the effect. And the effect in view is our choice, our will. All right? So there's a spectrum there, and compatible with that is over here, no responsibility, over here, responsibility. Now, by now, you're starting to realize that fatalism is not in a Christian paradigm. Can't be a Christian and be a fatalist. Can't be a Christian and not be responsible. That's incompatible with Christianity. So naturalism teaches fatalism. And naturalism is never Christian. Now we're back at the introduction to theology many semesters ago. So theism, any theistic perspective that believes there's a higher power, means in part that we're responsible to that higher power, and therefore we can't be fatalists, because fatalists don't have any responsibility. So among theists, or for our discussion tonight, among Christians, you can be a compatibilist or a libertarianist and still be a Christian. When you choose this, you're choosing with Augustine or Anselm or all the reformers. When you choose this, as long as you're choosing this consistent with Arminius and Wesley, you're okay. But Pelagius also taught libertarianism, and if that's why you're being a libertarian, that's not okay, because Pelagius is not a Christian on the grounds of what? Original sin. So, this is what we're talking about. These are your two options. You're either that or that. Is Calvinism compatibilism? Yes. Yeah, that'll come up. That'll really come up in soteriology, not so much as you consider at this point our will, but when you consider God's will. So when you begin to introduce that there is a will greater than our own will, and that it is a sovereign will, and that it is a will that decrees, and whatever he decrees is most certain to happen, then that begins to be argued as being fatalistic. But not at this level. At the level of the will, compatibilism is clearly consistent with John Calvin or Calvinism. But when you move beyond human will to God's will, which we will do in soteriology, you got to have this whole discussion again. Okay, now let's push into this, see if we can understand our two options. This is a diagram. This is what's in your notes. And this is not my diagram, and it's not the lesson writer's diagram. This was actually a diagram illustrating what Aristotle taught. Now, he didn't use pool balls. But here's what Aristotle taught. A man hits a rock with a stick. And here it's a man hitting a ball with a stick. The rock was moved by the stick. The stick was moved by the man. You're doing great. The stick and the rock cannot be blamed, Aristotle argued, for their actions. The man is to be blamed because he was the first cause of the event. Does that make sense? He was the genesis of all the activity concerning the stick and the ball. All of that resides with the person who took the first action. The cause is responsible. The effect cannot be held responsible. Only the cause can be held responsible. Now, that's good as far as it goes. And we would not be anti-Aristotelian as far as it goes. What he failed to do, and never did, was ask the next question. What caused the first action of the stick hitting the balls? The answer was the man. But we're not really interested in that. What we're interested in is what caused the man to do it. And Aristotle didn't answer that question with his world-famous and timeless illustration. The compatibilist and the fatalist, right? The compatibilist and the fatalist would want to know what caused him to hit the rock to begin with. What caused him to move the stick and hit the ball. However, the libertarian isn't interested in that because the cause and the effect are the same thing. The libertarian would say nothing caused him to hit the balls with the stick. He just hit the balls with the stick. So do you understand the distinction? Now, we're focusing on compatibilism as Christian. The compatibilist wants to ask the question, why did he move? So what we're looking for is the cause of that cause. He's not the first cause, we would argue, and I would argue. But the libertarian says that's a silly question. He caused it, and he was both cause and effect. So you can't separate the two. So libertarians would say Aristotle went far enough. Compatibilists would say there's another question we're yet to answer. So let's do it this way. Over here is the compatibilist. Over here is the libertarian. Here's the order of things concerning the compatibilist. Man is born with a nature. Now, original sin has already talked about that nature. But man is born with a nature. And from that nature come alongside, or with that nature come alongside outside influences. The family he's born in, the country he's born in, the political environment he's born in. And from nature, with outside influences, that human begins to shape values, develops a value system. The value system will be consistent with what? His nature first, and his influences secondly, what he was taught and the environment he was in. And now he begins to shape values. Those values will begin to shape his personality, and in that, what we're talking about is the kind of choices he will make. Will I laugh at funny things or cry at funny things? Well, you got a strange personality. Well, you know, it's my choice. Well, what causes you to act that way? Well, I was born this way. I've had these influences. They've shaped my values and my personality, my actions, my deportment is simply a reflection of those things. Then come other outside influences as you get older and as you mature. Maybe you get married. Maybe you change jobs. But in all of that, and only from all of that, does that individual, the compatibilist, make decisions, right or wrong. So what was the inevitable cause, what was the first cause of the decision? His nature was. It didn't exist alone. But if you're looking for the first cause of why that man chooses the way he chooses, the first cause will be his nature. That's the compatibilist argument. Now, if we go to the libertarian argument, it's entirely different. It's entirely different because remember, before we are going to make choices, we have to be made able to make choices. So there's the assumption that something has happened here that has allowed us to absolutely be free to make a choice. Unencumbered by what? Unencumbered by our nature, any outside influences, any values that we may have shaped, any personality that comes to be as a reflect of those values, and any other outside influences, those cannot have or be the cause of my decisions, because if they are, they're not free. You see, that decision there, the libertarian says, is not a free decision. It has to start with the decision. And so with that first decision that that person makes, if that's a right decision, that right decision now determines their nature. Remember, you got to grab a piece of Arminianism that says there was a prevenient grace that balanced the scales and removed the effects of the original sin so that this man has a what? An empty nature. It's blank. There is no nature. He's not guilty. But he's also not guilty. That will be determined when he makes his first choice. And that first choice, if he chooses rightly, will produce in him a nature fit to make right choices and inevitably a nature that will and can be saved. So I made a right choice, that first choice, completely unaffected by any other preceding causes. And now I made a right choice, which has affected me in a positive way in my nature that now shapes my values and my personalities, and along with all other outside influences, I will continue to make decisions, right or wrong. But the first cause of all of that was what? Me. So the first cause of these, we're still all going to do this, but the first cause here was my nature. The first cause here was the first choice I made. That's libertarianism. Now, what if you made the wrong choice? Well, remember, maybe Arminius taught that once you sin like Adam sinned, you are now guilty of Adam's sin. So once you make a wrong choice, uncoerced, as free as Adam was to make the right or wrong choice, uncoerced, once you've made that choice and it was wrong, you now take on what kind of nature? Fallen nature. Guilty nature. You didn't have that here. You had that here. You say, well, I thought he taught that you were born here. Well, you were, but everybody somewhere sometimes is going to get that erased by prevenient grace. Remember last week? The doctrine of prevenient grace in Arminian theology is universal. Everybody gets it. We don't know when they get it. We're not even sure how they get it, but it is certain that everybody gets it. And whenever that happened in the spectrum of a human's life, that next choice determined their nature to either be a guilty one or not a guilty one. And then subsequent choices will impact that. And so the wrong choice produces a wrong nature, producing wrong values and bad personality and inclinations toward choices. Other outside influences will come along and you'll just keep making choices. But what we're answering here is not how we're making this choices, What we're answering is what was the first cause. Do you see the difference? Compatibilists teach that the first cause was the nature of the man. Libertarians teach that that cannot be the first cause because then that first decision wasn't free. It was in some sense coerced. For the compatibilists, we got to go farther because we would say you're born a natural man. All people are born natural. And that nature, which was the first cause, is not just neutral, it's bent. And according to Romans 9:18, God just passes by those individuals. He gives them up. That nature is a sin nature, and God allows that nature to be, according to His will and purposes, sinful. He doesn't intervene. And so naturally, all humans are that, naturally. Now, God now begins to determine some things, according to Acts 17:26 and lots of other verses. He determines where this fallen nature, this broken man, this man who is now carrying the guilt of Adam, will be born, and the family into which they will be born. And all of those outside influences, God has now determined, but He's determined it not contrary to the nature, but the nature is what it is. Now He's beginning to make some determinations about that. Then those determinations, and through that, God begins to influence His values. He's taught good values, He's taught bad values, but God's not separated from either of those. God's influencing that fallen man through those things. And then God, through all of those things, is also influencing their personality. So you're seeing now that there is a God who's God over all of these things, but chose to leave the nature alone while He's influencing that nature and in some sense determining many things about that nature. And then God will determine or influence through employment, marriage, and again, we're not studying God's will and what degree He determines those things, but just acknowledging that the compatibilist believes that the first cause of everything is nature and the first nature of everyone is fallen. But that God was not disinterested in that. He was aware of that and allowed it, passed over that, and allowed every person to be born that way. And now in that fallen nature begins to influence that individual. This is the path of natural man. And guess what they're doing? Making choices every day. Now here's the question. Are those choices free? That's the question we're still trying to get to. When they make these choices, are they free choices? The compatibilist says, of course they're free, but that doesn't mean free from any influences. Because the choice itself is an effect, not a cause. Okay. Now, what happens when that man is regenerated? Well, now what God does is tip the scales by birthing in them a new life. And now their bent, which was toward evil, now is toward good. And now God determines, again, outside influences. He's still determining that. He may move you, displace you, whatever the case might be. Same with values and personality and outside influences. And now you're making choices. Both of these, the regenerate and the unregenerate man, are making choices. The question is, are they both making free choices? Or a better question, what was the cause of the choice? What's the cause of the choice for both the regenerate and the unregenerate, or the natural man and the regenerate man? What's the cause in both cases? It's on the graph. What is it? The nature. So this nature will cause different effects than this nature will cause. Are we good with that? It seems reasonable, at least. The nature has been altered, then the effects will change, and the effects are what we're talking about is our choices. All right, now let's look at the same thing with the libertarian, because here's what the libertarian believes. The libertarian believes, like the compatibilist, that the scale was tipped the wrong way, but God moves in and fixes that. prevenient grace. And now the first choice can be said to be absolutely free, without cause, or better said, it is both the cause and the effect. And determines then, this individual accepts Christ, gets a new nature, values begin to be shaped by that new nature and personality and decisions now, yes, are affected by that first nature, but that nature wasn't the cause. What was the cause? That first choice. First choice was the cause. It's always the first thing that's the cause. We're looking for the first in order. And for the libertarian, the first cause will always be the first choice they made, not their nature. Because the first choice they made altered their nature. And then here's the one that rejects Christ. Yes. Again, that's a soteriology question. So I think just for simplicity, so we can get through this, I'll beg not to answer that. It's a really, really good question. In fact, it's just a great question. I just don't have a very good answer. Well, what's the problems with compatibilism? Okay? Trusting you've understood a portion of this. Well, it is difficult to see how a person's acts can be both said to be free and at the same time determined. That's difficult. Those two words don't necessarily go together. So what do we mean when we say that? Well, we mean the compatibilist would say that a person's will is free, but that it had a determiner. And the determiner was, first cause was, what was it? Say it out loud. Nature. Well, that's difficult, though, because it doesn't sound free anymore. Secondly, why would God still find fault in man, in any man, if he is the first cause that placed him in the circumstances that have determined his choices? Now, that's a really good question. In other words, we say all of our choices are based on our first cause, and our first cause is our nature, and all of our nature is fallen. And who determined that? Who determined that you would be born with a fallen nature? Did you determine that? You did not determine that. God determined that when he determined to hold you guilty for Adam's sin. And it is very reasonable to say, why in the world could man be responsible if he wasn't really the first cause? So in other words, the argument against compatibilism's argument for the first cause being nature begs the next question. What caused the nature? And the only answer we can give is God did, and that is untenable. And that's untenable not just to an Arminian, that's untenable to all of us. That God caused us to be unregenerate and therefore fallen. But again, that's a different question for a different day. But this is the problems with compatibilism. Well, what's the problems with libertarianism? Well, first of all, as nice as it sounds, the Bible never teaches either explicitly or implicitly the idea of prevenient grace. So all of that notion of that first free choice, encumbered by nature or any other preceding cause, begs and demands that there be a first action by God to produce an equilibrium to make possible such a free choice. And the Bible just doesn't teach such a first work of grace. Either implicitly or explicitly, we looked at the only two texts last week that any Arminian theologian argues teaches prevenient grace, and it's a stretch in both cases. If a person's will is not affected either by predisposition or by outside influence, then it is, in fact, completely arbitrary. And this is a good one. Now, this is a philosophical argument. Arbitrary choices are not free choices. They are what? Random. Random. And there's a big difference between freedom and randomness. So in other words, if there's nothing else affecting you, there's no cause to the choice you make, and therefore it's the only kind of choice that could be called free, then the scale is tipped which way? Neither way. 50-50. So here you are in the parking lot at Walmart. I can't get a hold of my husband. I can't remember if he likes almond milk, right? Or what's the new one? Cashew milk. I don't know. I guess I'll have to choose. Yeah, that was Friday, and they're still sitting there. Why? Why? If the choice is both the cause and the effect, and there can be absolutely no cause to make the choice, then the only thing you're left with is not to make a choice. It's just not logical to assume choice absent some motivation, one way or the other. In other words, giving birth to, having a genesis of both desire, intent, will, and determination all in a split-hair second just doesn't make sense to me as a human, or us, we might say. So it's a problem to be that kind of free. Well, here's libertarian free will. There's our perfectly balanced scale. There's our prognosis of indetermination because we can't determine what to do because we're not inclined either way. And then somebody presents you with the huge stakes if you make the wrong choice. What did he just do? What did he just do when he presented you with the huge consequences if you make the wrong choice? What did he just do? Outside influence on the choice you will inevitably make. He's just trying to move you from this indecision that you're confronted with. Jonathan Edwards has this perspective. By determining the will, a phrase that he would say must be, the will must be determined. It's not the determiner. It has to be determined. If the phrase be used with any meaning, must be intended, what must be intended by that phrase, is causing that the act of the will or choice should be thus. In other words, what do we mean? We mean that the act or the actual choice has to be caused. That's what we mean when we say it had to be determined. And it cannot be otherwise. And the will is said to be determined when, in consequence of some action or influence, its choice is directed to and fixed upon a particular object. That's just his way of saying you can't make a choice that's undetermined. Something has to move it. Whatever that thing was that moved it can be said to be the cause. And the choice itself, the will itself, is the effect. Jonathan Edwards again. Let's see if this one makes any more sense, right? To talk of the determination of the will supposes an effect, which must have a cause. If the will be determined, there is a determiner. This must be supposed to be intended even by them that say the will determines itself. Well, if that be so, the will is both determiner and determined. In other words, you haven't ruled out the determiner. You've just made them the same thing. It is a cause that acts and produces effects upon itself and is the object of its own influence and its own action, to which Jonathan Edwards and any reasonable thinking human would say, that's just ridiculous. All the laws of nature itself don't allow for cause and effect to be the same thing. That's what he's arguing. It's just, he would say, if he were me, it's just stupid. Because it doesn't make any sense. Okay, but he's not me and you're glad he's not me. But I sometimes make more sense than he does on these kind of things. Well, look at what R.C. Sproul says. In a technical sense, nothing occurs by chance. For chance has no being and can exercise no power. It is one thing to say that we do not know what causes a given effect, or you might say, I don't know why I made the choice. But it is quite another thing to say that nothing caused the effect. Nothing cannot do anything because it is not anything. Now, I've got a blank screen up here next, and it's your turn to write your little sentence. No, I'm just kidding. But I think we follow this. We don't usually think this way, and I wouldn't recommend you try this tomorrow, like on the job, Brent. But, yeah, I wouldn't go here. Just ask the guy why he dropped the window and broke it. Just ask him why. And he'll say, no reason. No reason. And you'll say, I don't buy that, right? You wouldn't buy that. I'd say, well, then it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It just didn't happen. Okay. Number three. The Bible does teach that people's choices are affected. And in fact, it teaches that people's choices are affected by other people's choices. The Bible says, you shall not worship them or serve them in Deuteronomy 20, verse 5. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, and I will visit, look, the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, the things that the fathers do, the attitudes that they create, the environments in which they raise their children will have an effect on the choices that the next children make. So God seems to teach that those choices of those children won't be completely free. They will have had a cause. Mark 9:42, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe to stumble, it would be better for him if, with a heavy millstone hung around his neck, he had been cast into the sea. Jesus seems to believe that other humans can cause
certain actions and determinations and therefore choices that humans make. Well, let's talk about this real quickly. Pelagian free will, right? This is not Christian, but we're going to introduce you to some Latin here because we love Latin here. And we're going to talk about unfallen, that's Adam. We could have just said Adam. We're going to talk about every human who has fallen, and then you get saved and you're redeemed and then inevitably get glorified. What is the differing effects or manifestations of the will in all of those states according to Pelagius? Well, first of all, Adam, you see this word here? Somebody say that for me, those two words. Boy, he even put like a little trill in there. So say that again louder where everybody can hear and appreciate that. It really was good. I'm impressed. Say it again. Okay. You know what that means? Posse, able, and picare, to sin. The unfallen man, Adam, was able to sin. And able not to sin. He was not fallen, and as it regards his will, he was able to sin and able not to sin. Therefore, he was free to choose evil or good. The graph makes some sense now, right? That's kind of cool. Now, we're not Adam. We're just fallen. So what did Pelagius teach concerning fallen man? No difference. Able to sin, able to not sin, free to choose. In other words, he taught no doctrine of original sin, no effect. But he did believe you could be redeemed. And what happens if you're redeemed? Nothing. Able to sin and able not to sin. Well, does it ever get any better? Yes, when you go to heaven. Not able to sin. The only choice you can make is a good one. All right, that's Pelagianism. It's not Christian because it denies any effect of the fall. What does Arminianism look like in this graph? Unfallen Adam was able to sin, able not to sin, freely choose evil and good. Fallen man, like Adam, or I should say unlike Adam, is, what does this say? Able to sin, not able not to sin. In other words, the effect of the fall were complete. He is not able not to sin. But because of prevenient grace, he is made able not to sin. And when that happens, he is now able to sin and able not to sin. He's just like Adam. Prevenient grace in Arminianism makes fallen man just like Adam and can freely choose evil or good. You see it? Okay. What happens when he's saved? Well, when he's saved, he's now able to sin and able not to sin. Well, what happens when he goes to heaven? He's not able to sin. Follow that? Again, what does Arminianism teach regarding the fall? Good, solid, original sin. What does Arminianism teach regarding the will? It has to be effective in order for it to ever be effective in salvation. Something has to happen to it. And when it happens, he becomes like Adam again until he makes the first choice. Augustinian free will. Adam was able to sin, able not to sin, no difference. Fallen man is not able to not sin. Every choice he makes is evil. That is distinctly different from the fundamentals of Arminianism. So it doesn't mean he's not able to make a good choice, but any good choice he made would still be a sinful choice because without faith it is impossible to please God. It cannot be considered a good choice in any godly sense or righteous sense. When he's redeemed, he is able to sin and able not to sin. So you see, redemption has a profound effect. In Augustinianism, which is next semester, but you'll recall just a moment ago, redemption had no effect regarding the will from fallen to redeemed. And then in glory, not able to sin. Only choices you can make will be good choices. Now we could pause right here and wrestle to the ground a couple of things that I think are really helpful. What we're in pursuit of tonight is when and to what degree is man ever free to choose? And what Augustinianism argues, since that's the graph on the board, is, was man free to choose here? Yes. Was that choice in any sense encumbered by anything? In other words, was he ever absolutely free? Was Adam ever absolutely free to choose whatever he might choose? Well, those were consequences, but it didn't limit his freedom. The answer we would give is yes. He was absolutely free because his nature is his first cause, and his nature was not fallen. Which begs the question, the much more profound question in Augustinianism concerning Adam is, was he able to sin? And if so, why? If the first cause is nature, and his nature was good, what caused him to sin? His good nature? See, that's the wheel we get wrapped around on Augustinianism. Again, that's another class, but I'm trying to help you here. Now, here, is this guy free to choose? He is free to choose if what you mean by that he's making choices and that he's free to make those choices. But if you mean that he's libertarianism free, he's not, because he's making choices bound by the first cause, which is his nature. Here, is he free to choose? Free to choose. Bound by what? A new nature, a redeemed nature. Craig mentioned earlier that free will might or should include the possibility of a contrary choice. Craig was ahead of us because both of these argue for the ability to choose contrary to your nature. See, we do not believe that when a Christian is redeemed that he'll always make good choices. What we believe is that he has a nature that is the first cause of the choices, right? But he doesn't always make good choices. He's free to make contrary choices. And inevitably, we're going to have to ask the question, and we're going to do it here even though it's 7 o'clock. We're going to do it really fast, that there's a missing element here. How can you make a choice contrary to nature if nature's the first cause? And here my nature's been changed. Why do Christians sin? That's what we're asking. Why do they sin? And the answer is because there's something else that we haven't put on the table yet in all of this discussion tonight. We've ascribed the first cause being nature, but it's not the only cause. And so we need to see if we can make some sense out of that. So let's do that really fast. These are my pictures, so you don't have these. But there's three things we're talking about that we need to talk about. Freedom and will, all right? That's what we're talking about, choices, and are they free? Secondly, nature, but this is the word we haven't talked about, and that's desire. They're not the same thing, but from our nature come desires. And then we have to have ability on the map. Now, to help us think through this, we're just thinking through this. We're not answering every question. And if you're new to theology, we're really not interested in answering every question. We like to ask the questions. And then later, we keep working these things out. So this isn't going to answer everything, but I just want you to think this way, and I want to send you home thinking this way. Let's start with a lion. All right, here's a lion. And what we're going to put in front of this lion is this wonderful, beautiful, luscious, juicy green grass. And here's the question. Does the lion have freedom to eat the grass? My answer is, he does. All right, let's ask a second question. Does he have the ability to eat the grass? He does. He's got all the necessary body parts to eat the grass. But is it consistent with his nature to eat the grass? It is not. Meaning, he doesn't have any desire to eat the grass. Follow that? So it would lead me to say that this lion will not eat the grass. I cannot say he could not eat the grass. You with me? He will not eat the grass because he doesn't desire to. I could only say he could not eat the grass if he didn't have the ability to. But he does have the ability to, so he could eat the grass. But he will not eat the grass because it's contrary to his nature, and his nature is manifesting itself through what? Desires. So as we go back the chain of what caused me to make the decision, before you get to nature, there's this other element, and it's the desire. And we're supposing, at least here, that the desire emanates from the nature. And so he's going to make a choice consistent with his desire, not consistent with his ability, and he'll be free to do it. I'm not going to hold him back. You're not going to hold him back. But we would also argue that he's not free to do it because his desire doesn't exist. And so I would say he's the libertarian would say he's free to do it as long as he has the ability to do it. Because they don't care what his nature is, because his nature doesn't do it. But they do care that he has the ability to do it. We studied that earlier. You got to have the ability or you can't be responsible. We would say, and Augustinian would say, well, he has the ability, but without the desire, he really doesn't have the freedom. In other words, we would say his freedom is bound by his nature. It's bound by his nature. And in that sense, we would say, yes, we believe his will is free, but we don't mean the same way you mean it. We don't mean he's libertarian free. We mean he's determination free. In other words, he's free to do what his nature determines him to do. And that's manifest by his desire. Well, let's do this a little differently. What if we put a steak in front of it? Is he free to eat the steak? Same way, right? So far, does he have the ability to eat the steak? He does. Does he have the natural desire to eat the steak? He does. And we would say, see, he's absolutely free. Is that what we're saying? No. When it's all check marks, it seems like we're just all Arminians. Because we're saying, see, he's got to have the ability and the nature in order to be considered really free. So God has to fix the nature and has to provide the ability. Otherwise, it's not free. They would say, that's what we mean right there. But we would say, you know what? Even though he has the natural tendency to eat the steak, and even though he has the ability to eat the steak, guess what? He ain't hungry. And he can choose not to eat the steak. He can choose contrary to his what? Nature? Can he choose contrary to his ability? He can. And when you posit these kind of questions, though we're not fleshing it all out, it becomes untenable for the Arminian argument. You can't disconnect choices from ability. You can't say they're still free. And we would say, yeah, this is real freedom. The freedom not to choose in accord with your nature or your ability. And that works great for lions. But we're not lions, we're people. So here we are. And now, what would we put in front of this person? Let's put flying. Here's a human, and there's the concept of flying. Does the human have the ability to fly? He does not. Does he have the desire to fly? Oh, not if he's sane. It's only crazy people who jump off of balconies. He does not. We would say in some sense then that there's a relationship between ability and natural desire. There's some relationship there. Absent the ability, it's not reasonable to say that it's natural for a man to fly. Because none of us are going to say it's natural for a man to fly. The desire kind of gives us a bent, and I want it to give us a bent because we comfortably connected desire to nature, but that's not always the case. The lion has a nature to eat the steak, but he might not have a desire to eat the steak. The man doesn't have a nature to fly, and some of you are ready to jump off a balcony. Here's the question, is he free to fly? He's not free to fly. He neither has the ability nor the natural inclination to fly. Do you agree with this one? And the Arminian says, see, freedom of the will demands ability and a natural inclination. So sometimes these really reasonable arguments make that case. This would make that case. But is there an exception to that where you could be said to be free without the ability? Can you be said to be free without the natural inclination? Is there ever a context where you could imagine that you could speak of real freedom? In fact, even the highest order of freedom, even though there's no ability and no inclination. Well, there is. But it's not about man, it's about God. Can you imagine a being ever, anywhere, at any time, more free than God? If you have any concept of freedom, you got to say God's free, right? Free in a way we'll never be free. Free in a way we could never even hope to be free. So I'm going to start there and say God's absolutely free. But if I put in front of God, well, we need a context for this. Let's say I put in front of God sin. Does God have the ability to sin?
He doesn't. The Bible, he says he doesn't. He says, I, for instance, cannot lie. I can't. I don't have the ability to do that. Why not? Because it's contrary to my nature. So it's contrary to God's nature to sin. He is entirely other than sin. And because of that, or vice versa, he does not have the ability to sin. He cannot sin. He must be holy. Is he therefore not free? I don't think any of us want to go there. And so this is a really powerful example in this context for you to consider that is there such a thing as real, I mean talking top drawer freedom, without ability and without nature or desire? Does God have a desire to sin? He has no desire to sin. So this is possible. That idea at the top is a possible combination. So let's put man back up here. So we don't have the ability, we don't have the nature. Could it still be said then that we are like God and free to fly? No, I just think that's a stretch. I'm going to leave that one blank. You can figure that out for yourself. But we don't talk about humans and flying very often. We do talk about humans and sin. Do we have the ability to sin? Yeah, we do. Do we have the nature inclined towards sin? We do. In other words, do we desire to sin? We do. So are we free to sin? Are we free to sin? You got to put a check there, don't you? Are we free to sin? We are free to sin. Well, in that, with Craig's jump start earlier, do we have the freedom to act contrary to that? Do we have the freedom to make a contrary choice? Do we have the freedom not to sin, even though we have the ability and the desire? We do. We have the freedom not to sin. And I'm saying that up there negatively. So, what are we learning here? I'm not really sure. Let's do this a different way. Let's put something else in front of man. Let's put righteousness in front of man. Does a human being have the ability for righteousness? This is a tricky one. Yes. Nothing that God requires of us in His law do we lack the human ability to do. We're talking about ability here. But do we have the desire to do it? Do we have, as natural man, the desire for righteousness? We don't. Now, where does that leave us? See, you can mix these things around a little bit, and all I'm trying to do is help you to think through these things. The libertarian wants to say what? Free. Why? Because he had the ability, and that freedom, nature's never in their picture. Nature was fixed. It was neutered. Nothing to do with desire, but you do have to have the ability. So the libertarian can only put a check over there. Free to be what? Righteous. Free to be righteous. Well, what about the Augustinian? What was his first cause? Ability? Nature. So he's not going to agree there, is he? Not going to agree. He's going to disagree. But sometimes these disagreements aren't as clear as maybe we think they are. Now, I'm not going to give any more pictures. I'm just trying to help you think through this, just a way to process this. Because when you get to this point right here, as it regards righteousness, and you imagine a human with the ability but absent the desire, but you've believed a theology where the desire doesn't matter, then anybody at any time is free to choose to be saved. Free to choose. All they had to have was the ability. That's all they had to have. It didn't have anything to do with their nature, anything to do with their desires. They're free at any time to choose to believe. Now, have you ever been to that church? one more verse, because one more person might decide today, consistent with the ability to choose. God doesn't have to do anything to his nature. God doesn't have to do anything to his desires. He will be the genesis of all of that because he's absolutely free. Because if there's any other answer, then he was never free. And if he was never free, then salvation is in itself as a concept is not just. Okay, so these are the things that come into view when you think about this question of free will. So I'm going to send you home with this. Is there such a thing as free will? Well, yes and no. No, if you mean that we have libertarian freedom or freedom to choose against our nature, what Augustine defined as against our liberty. And I'm telling you here not what Arminians believe, but what we believe. But yes, you do have a free will if you mean you will always be free to choose according to your greatest desire, and that you are bound by the inclinations of your nature to such a degree that you will never choose against that greatest desire. Ever. And you're left with really one question from our theological perspective, and that is, where does that desire come from? Where does that desire come from? Okay? Any questions? Oh, don't have time. You can email questions. I said at the beginning, a couple years ago, we spent a whole summer on freedom of the will. We worked through Jonathan Edwards' treatise on that. This is a deep subject. I've tried to add a little bit of brevity to it just to kind of get us through it. Think long and hard about these things. You're not so challenged at this point. It's like, well, there's not a test, right? Well, there is a test coming in soteriology. Your thinking about this will be sorely tested when you start talking about the doctrine of election and predestination and redemption and atonement and regeneration and justification and sanctification. There's not a spectrum of your ultimate glorification that will not challenge your thinking about your will. Because I've said to you before, and I'll say it now and you can go home, none of us have a Christian experience that wasn't the experience that we made a what? Choice. We made a choice. And all we've talked about tonight is, was there something that caused that? Two schools of thought. One says no. One says yes. See ya.